A little before noon, the spoor changed direction again and ran due east. "We've gained an hour or two on him," Sean whispered to Capo. "But Matatu doesn't like it, and neither do I. He's spooky and tense, and he's heading straight for the Mozambique border now." "Do you think he has sensed us?" Capo was worried, but Sean shook his head. "Impossible. We are still hours behind him." They stopped again briefly at noon to eat and rest. And when they went on again, they hadn't gone more than a mile before they entered a grove of marula trees. The ripe yellow fruit lay thickly on the ground beneath them, and the old bull had not been able to resist that. He had fed heartily, spending at least 3 hours in the grove, shaking the trees to bring down more fruit, and then at last setting off again eastwards, as though suddenly remembering a rendezvous. "At least we have gained 3 hours on him," Sean told them, but he was frowning. "We are only 10 miles from the Mozambique border. If he crosses, we've lost him." Sean considered running the spoor. In the old days of the bush war, he and Job and Shadrach never walked in pursuit of the enemy. Running, they had been able to cover 60 or 70 miles in a single day. He glanced back at Claudia. She might surprise him, for she moved like an athlete, and despite the incipient blisters, there was still spring and snap in her step. And then he looked back at Ricardo and abandoned the idea. Capo was wilting in the 95-degree heat of the valley. Sean tended to forget sometimes that Ricardo was only a year or two short of 60. He had always been so fit. But now he was showing signs of distress, his eyes sunken in plum-coloured hollows, and a greyish cast to his skin. "Old beggar is looking sick," Sean thought. "I can't push him harder." He had let his attention wander, and now he almost ran into Matatu as the tracker stopped suddenly, still hunched over the spoor. "What is it?" he demanded. The little man's agitation was obvious. He was shaking his head and muttering in that obscure Ndorobo dialect that even Sean couldn't understand. "What?" Sean broke off as he saw it. "Oh, shit," he blurted. 2 separate pairs of human tracks had come in from the side and now overlaid the elephant bull's pad marks. Here the earth was sandy and friable, the tracks clear. 2 men wearing rubber-soled shoes, Sean recognised the distinctive pattern of the soles. Those ubiquitous Bata tennis shoes, locally manufactured and sold for a few dollars in every street market and general dealer's store. Even Ricardo picked out the alien human prints. "Who the hell is that?" he demanded. But Sean ignored him and drew aside with Job to watch Matatu work. Matatu scurried back and forth, picking over the spoor like an old hen, and then came back to them. They squatted down, Job on one side of Sean, Matatu on the other. The Council of War, from which only Shadrach was missing.
2 men, one young and tall and thin. He walks on his toes. The other older, shorter, fatter. Both are carrying packs and banduki.
Sean knew he had deduced all this from the length of stride, the different way the 2 men heeled and toed under packs, and the unbalancing of a heavy weapon carried in one hand.
They are foreigners. The men of the valley do not wear shoes, and these men came in from the north.
Zambian poachers, Job grunted. They're after rhino horn, but they stumbled on the elephant, and he's too big to let pass.
Bastards, said Sean bitterly.
In 1970, there had been an estimated 12,000 black rhinoceros left in Zambia across the Zambezi River. Now there were none, not a single animal left. A Yemeni nobleman would pay $50,000 for a dagger with a rhinoceros horn handle, and the poachers organized themselves like military expeditions. There were still a few hundred rhinoceros left on the southern side of the Zambezi Valley, and from the Zambian side, the poachers crossed the river in the night, slipping past the game department patrols. Many of the poachers had been bushfighters in the guerrilla war. They were hard men and killers of men, as well as of the great animals on which they preyed.
They'll be carrying AKs, Job looked at him.
And there are probably more than two men. They will have outflankers. We're outnumbered and outgunned, Sean. What do you want to do?
This is my concession, Sean said. And Tukutila is my elephant.
Then you might have to fight them for both.
Job's noble Matabele features were solemn, but his eyes sparkled. He couldn't conceal the battle lust in them.
Sean stood up. Damned right, Job. If we catch them, we're going to fight them.
Then we must hurry. Matatu stood up beside them. There are 2 hours ahead of us, and Tukutila must stop soon to feed. They will have him before we get there.
Sean strode across to where Ricardo and Claudia were resting in the shade. Poachers, he told them, probably armed with automatic weapons. 2 at least, possibly more. All of them ruthless killers.
They stared at him wordlessly, and Sean went on.
We will have to move fast to prevent them getting to Tukutila before we do.
I'll leave you and Claudia to follow with Pumula at your own speed. Job and Matatu and I are going to run the spoor and try to drive them off before they get to the elephant.
You keep the Rigby, Capo, and Job will take the Witherby.
As he began to turn away, Ricardo caught his arm.
Sean, I want this elephant. More than anything left in my life, I want this elephant.
I will try and save him for you, Sean nodded.
He understood entirely. He felt the same way.
Thank you.
Ricardo let his hand fall to his side, and Sean went to where Job and Matatu were waiting. They had handed over their field packs to Pumula and carried only their water bottles. Sean glanced at his stainless steel Rolex. 4 minutes since they picked up the poacher's spoor, 4 minutes wasted.
Hot pursuit, Sean ordered, and expect ambush.
Job smiled at him.
Old times, he said. It makes me feel young again.
Matatu pulled his loincloth up between his legs and tucked the skirt under his belt, then whirled and went away on the spoor at a loping trot. Sean had seen him keep up that pace from sunup to sundown. He went out onto the right flank, and Job, who was left-handed, took his natural side. Sean changed the cartridges in the .577 and began to run. Within seconds, Ricardo's group was out of sight in the forest behind them, and Sean concentrated all his attention ahead. It required special skills and vast experience to keep the formation intact in this type of broken country. The flankers had to keep slightly ahead of the tracker, anticipating the line of the spoor, sweeping the terrain for ambush, covering and protecting Matatu, and yet keeping 50 paces out on each side, breaking their own trail, and still maintaining contact with the opposite flanker, all this while on the run and mostly out of sight of each other, with Matatu setting a furious pace in the centre. When the spoor turned, the man on the outer flank had to wheel on the centre, covering twice the distance of his opposite number, and when the spoor crossed open ground, they had to increase the angle on the flank, forming an inverted spearhead formation, always protecting the centre, keeping contact with subtle bird calls, the flute of a wood dove, the whistle of a bulbul, the warble of a shrike, the pipe of a black kite. Each had meaning, each a command or a warning. All this, and 2 other essentials, silence and speed. Job and Sean ran like a pair of kudu bulls, lightly and soundlessly, ducking and weaving under branches, through thickets and thorns, quick and vigilant. After the first hour, Matatu flashed a hand signal down a break in forest, and Sean understood it readily.
2 more, the signal said.
Another pair of poachers had joined the first 2, and they also were closing swiftly with the elephant. They ran for another hour, never slackening for a moment, and Matatu signalled again from the centre.
Very close.
An eloquent flash of his pink palm. Beware danger. And Sean whistled like a sand grouse, checking the pace. The signal for imminent contact, and they came down to a wary trot. The trail had led them up the side of a low tableland, along an ancient elephant trail that was well trodden into the iron-hard earth. When they came out on top of the flat plateau, they felt the stir of the evening breeze, cool and blessed out of the east,
and Sean held his sweaty face up to it. The plateau was less than a mile wide, and they crossed it quickly and reached the far rim, dropping to their bellies and sliding over the skyline without showing a silhouette against the blue, and then crouching below the crest and sweeping the ground below them, a shallow valley with another forested tableland beyond. A river bed meandered down the centre of the valley, its course marked with a narrow ribbon of dark green riverine bush, and the rest of the valley fairly open, pale, winter grass shining in the sunlight, dotted ant hills each the size of a cottage, widely separated umbrella acacia with flat tops and lemon-yellow trunks. Sean surveyed it all swiftly. Out on the left, Job gave the penny-whistle snort of a reed buck, one of the most urgent alarm calls in their repertoire. He was pointing down into the valley, half left from their front. Sean followed the gesture. For a moment he saw nothing, and then suddenly Tukutila, the angry one, stepped into view. He'd been hidden from Sean by one of the huge anthills, but now he strode out into the open meadow, and Sean gasped aloud. Even from almost a mile away, Sean realized that he had only poorly remembered the magnificence of this animal. Tukutila was the dark grey of volcanic rock, tall and gaunt. Even at this distance, Sean could make out the folds and tucks of his ancient riven hide and the knotted outline of his spine beneath it. His ears fanned gently with each stride, and their edges were tattered and eroded, like a pair of battle ensigns torn with shot and blackened with the smoke of cannon. Tukutila's tusks were black also, stained with age and the sap of the tall trees he'd destroyed with them. From his gaping lower lip, the tusks flared outwards and then curved in again towards each other, so that the tips almost met 9 feet from his lip. They were without taper, solid columns of ivory, hanging so low that in the centre they drooped below the level of the winter grass, and they seemed to overburden even that massive frame. There would probably never be another pair of tusks like that ever again. This elephant was legend and history. Sean felt a hot flare of guilt. No matter the legality of it, the killing of this beast would be a crime against Africa, an affront to the gods of the wilderness and the very soul of man. Yet he knew he would not hesitate to do it, and that knowledge added poignancy to his sense of guilt. As a hunter, the nobler the quarry, the greater the compulsion to take the trophy. Job whistled again, pointing, diverting Sean's attention from the elephant, and only then Sean saw the poachers. They were already closing in on the bull. He could see all four of them. They had just left the trees at the bottom of the slope and were moving in single file into the grass meadow. The grass reached to their armpits, and their heads and shoulders bobbed like a cork line of fishing net in the pale sea of grass. Each of them carried an AK-47 assault rifle hung over his shoulder. The light, swift bullets those weapons fired were not at all suitable for hunting massive-bodied species. But Sean knew the technique. They would get in close and all four would open fire together, blazing hundreds of rounds into the bull, riddling his lungs with copper-jacketed bullets, bringing him down under the sheer weight of automatic firepower.